Thank you for supporting WBEZ. You keep public media public. December gifts are among the most important because they set the tone for our reporting in 2026. Next year, we're doubling down on bringing you stories that arm you with the facts. This journalism relies on everyone contributing what they can. Join them today at wbez.org/donate.
I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is Reset. It's Friday the 13th, but as we do every Friday, time to catch up on what's been happening lately across Chicago and Illinois in our weekly news recap, where we take you behind the headlines with local journalists working on stories like these.
Chicago police showed up in force when thousands of anti-ICE protesters marched in downtown.
A scene near Monroe and Wabash where a red-colored sedan reportedly sped through a group of protesters.
Former House Speaker Mike Madigan, once considered the most powerful man in the state, will be sentenced in federal court.
This week's panel included Laura Rodriguez-Presa, who covers immigration and the Latino community for the Chicago Tribune, Carrie Shepard, Chicago reporter with Axios, and our very own Mitchell Armantrout, government and politics reporter for the Chicago Sun-Times. Before we dove into the news of the week with the folks in the studio, we pulled in a fourth panelist, Sun-Times federal courts reporter John Seidel, who was waiting on the sentencing of former House Speaker Michael Madigan. He filled us in on what the scene was like at the Dirksen Federal Courthouse.
We've got lots of people just waiting for the guest of honor to arrive. I'm in the lobby of the courthouse right now. We've got a bullpen full of TV cameras and camera people waiting outside of the building. I mean, it's just it's all in anticipation of this hearing that's supposed to begin in a little less than an hour.
Mm-hmm. And so how long of a sentence could Madigan get here?
You know, Judge Blakey is going to have a lot of options here. If he really wants to send a strong message, he could give Michael Madigan a really heavy sentence. In fact, prosecutors asked for 12 and a half years for the former speaker. Mm. It seems unlikely that Madigan would get a sentence that high, though. Recall that Ed Burke, the former alderman, was sentenced just about a year ago. Prosecutors asked for 10 years for him. Mm-hmm. He left the building with a 2-year prison sentence that he's now serving.
I hear Shirley Madigan, who's Mike Madigan's wife of almost 50 years, I heard she made quite a dramatic plea ahead of the sentencing. What happened?
She did. They filed a video plea from Shirley Madigan a week ago. And in it, she discussed her a long marriage with Michael Madigan, discussed dating Michael Madigan, and, you know, what kind of a father he was to the family, talked about how he came to adopt Lisa Madigan, who was, of course, the former Illinois Attorney General. But she also made the point, and I think this is crucial for what the defense is trying to do here, that she has health problems. She talked about having COVID and pneumonia and other issues. And she said point blank that if her husband goes to prison, she's going to have to find a caretaker. So it's not just going to be a hardship on Michael Madigan. It's going to be a hardship on his wife, who's going to have to find someone else to take care of her. Now, I should point out that this is an argument that judges hear often from the defendants. Sometimes judges take that very seriously. Other times they kind of respond with the remark that the defendant should have thought of that when he or she was committing their crimes.
Right.
We'll have to see how Judge Blakey takes it.
And here's the thing. She's not the only one that's asking the judge for leniency, right? There are other high-profile folks calling for a lighter sentence.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, Michael Madigan filed nearly 250 letters of support a few weeks ago. I believe the names in there include, of course, his children, including Lisa Madigan. I believe former Governor Jim Edgar was in there, many others. And, you know, hailing back to the Burke sentencing a year ago, once again, that was crucial. We see judges sometimes take these letters very seriously. And Judge Virginia Kendall, when she sentenced Burke last year, leaned heavily on the fact that she had just letter after letter after letter detailing good works by Ed Burke that, you know, people didn't really know he was doing. This is just behind the scenes stuff. And now Madigan has presented Judge Blakey with the same kind of supporting evidence. And we'll see how the judge deals with that.
All right. So on Monday, Madigan's defense attorneys made one last attempt to get a new trial. What was that about?
Well, they challenged a lot of the rulings in this case. And what that really did was kind of preview what we're going to see when Madigan likely appeals all of this to the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, which is something we'd expect to happen after he is sentenced here. But, you know, those, you know, as aggravating as that may sound when defendants ask for a new trial or even acquittal in the face of a jury's guilty verdict, it's very routine. This is, you know, it's something that defense attorneys that they have to ask. And Judge Blakey, when he got up on the bench on Monday, he very quickly denied it. There was no real argument or commentary. I believe he said there's going to be a written ruling forthcoming. We haven't seen that yet.
Yeah. Now, President Trump's been on a bit of a pardoning spree. Are folks wondering whether he might pardon Illinois' former House Speaker?
It's a question that's come up, and it's inevitable in this day and age, right? I mean, Rod Blagojevich, who's really the most significant corruption defendant in this courthouse, up till now, like the last really, you know, significant person that we saw here, he was pardoned by Trump earlier this year. In fact, he told WBEZ that he didn't even ask for that pardon. Trump just did it. And of course, Trump commuted the sentence of former, Gangster Disciples co-founder Larry Hoover. So with all of this going on, the question has to be asked. And, you know, nobody really knows. Madigan's team isn't saying whether this is something they're pursuing. But I think what's been pointed out to us is that there likely has to be something in it for Trump. But if there's, you know, some way that Trump sees something in it for him, you know, observers think that, yeah, it's very believable that Trump could intervene. I was also told that the higher the sentence, the more likely he is to intervene.
Well, listen, I know there's a lot for you to keep your eye on at the courthouse. But before I let you go, John, federal prosecutors also announced that they're going to hold a new trial for a different state lawmaker whose April trial ended in a hung jury. So fill us in.
Yeah, Senator Emile Jones III, who's the son of the former Senate President Emile Jones Jr., he went to trial on bribery charges in April. And, the trial ended in a hung jury. And it was one in a series of trials, with Madigan's really being the exception in the last year, corruption trials ending without a conviction. And there were a lot of people who were kind of scratching their head about this case afterward. People thought that maybe it wasn't a very strong case. But the government made clear this week that they want to try again. And so I don't believe a new trial date has been set for Emile Jones. I think that's going to maybe happen later this month. And it's just to throw it out there, of course, there's also the former AT&T Illinois president, Paul Lastiazza. His trial ended in a hung jury last fall as well. They've got, I believe, a January retrial coming for him.
We'll leave it there with Sun-Times Federal Courts reporter John Seidel. John, thank you so much for checking in.
Glad to do it. Take care.
Mitch and Carrie, I know federal prosecutors, they've had quite a few setbacks lately. Three of the last four corruption trials here in Chicago, they ended without a conviction. Is there some kind of feeling that they might be overreaching in some of these cases?
I don't think so. I mean, and like, to be clear, they got a conviction on Madigan. We're just in the sentencing phase.
Well,
and, you know, good question to John about Trump stepping in. I don't see that. I don't predict that happening.
Had to ask. It's
of course. It's, of course. I mean,
it's random when it happens.
Yeah.
So you never know.
I would say, you know, Madigan very strongly represents the Democrats here in Illinois, which Trump hasn't been too keen on, especially here in Illinois. One of his major foes being Governor Pritzker, of course. So unless Madigan really kowtows to the president, I'm not sure that is going to get a pardon.
Yeah. Mitch, we've got another state lawmaker facing a campaign finance controversy. What is happening with Senate President Don Harmon?
So Don Harmon, he's facing some pretty hefty fines from the Illinois State Board of Elections for allegedly violating state campaign finance law. It gets a little bit convoluted, but essentially he's accused of raising more money than he was allowed to under the so-called campaign caps. Wealthier candidates, once a candidate raises $100,000 or more, essentially anybody can throw as much money into a race as possible or as they want under state law. He's essentially accused of raising more money than that within a 2-year period And he caught some flack for this in the last couple of weeks because there was a very late stage push in the end of the legislative session in Springfield by Harmon to pass a law that would essentially wipe his slate clean before the State Board of Elections. You know, he says that he was just trying to kind of make the law more equitable across the board in the State House and Senate. But there's a lot of government reform advocates who say that this is pretty bald-headed, you know, a pretty self-serving law here.
All right, Laura, let's put these political corruption trials behind us because there was a lot of other news this week. Chicago, as we know, was one of many U.S. cities that saw protesters. They were out in full force all week long. What's been going on?
Well, we have seen what's been going on in L.A., right? The militarized now ICE raids that are happening all across the city. And that's what we're expecting to happen here in Chicago as soon as tomorrow. So, you know, the marches started because of as a response to those raids that are happening and the in solidarity with L.A., but I think that people here are just more so getting ready to protect or the community here in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
I think that, you know, that there's been different groups that are organizing these protests. So we need to remember who these groups are and be able to identify them. There has been some concern from the leading pro-immigrant groups that there are certain political groups that are organizing some of these protests to kind of infiltrate and create some of the violence that has been highlighted by the Trump administration. So so right now they're trying to be really strategic in how to handle this. And obviously we saw some of those protests over the week. We know we had 17 people arrested during the first protest.
At least,
right? And we are actually expecting the largest one tomorrow.
Yeah.
So,
and on that protest where 17 at least were arrested, the National Lawyers Guild of Chicago, they had observers there and they said, quote, the police response was especially violent and aggressive. That matches what you were hearing too?
Yes. I think that in Chicago specifically, there's always been this movement, right, against police. So I think that right now there is this combination of this hate almost, right, to authority. And so that includes ICE agents and police.
Mm-hmm.
I think this also happened because of the accusations that Chicago police got from the alleged cooperation with ICE agents at the raid that happened. I mean, not at the raid, at the arrest that happened outside the South Loop office.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that right now there is a lot of anger from both sides. And
which the police say they weren't cooperating.
Right. They said they were not cooperating. They were just trying to control the crowd.
Mm-hmm. Now, police are still looking for, there was a driver who plowed through a crowd of protesters.
Yes.
Tell us more.
Yeah. So there was a red small car that just kind of drove through the crowd. Thankfully, based on what, you know, we reported, no one was hurt initially, but then we learned that, in fact, there was a 66-year-old woman that was injured during that incident. We don't know yet, right, like why, if this was something against the protesters. This was, you know, someone that agrees with the raids. It's unknown why that happened.
What the motive was. Yeah.
Right, but it certainly caused a lot of concern, especially with some of those groups, pro-immigrant leading groups that organized or that are organizing some of the protests.
Mm-hmm.
We also have to remember that a lot of these folks, you know, there's a lot of fear amongst the undocumented community. So many of those people would be the ones joining some of these protests. Right now, they are not the ones. There's actually a call for them to stay home. So they're calling on U.S. citizens or U.S. citizen children to come out and protest. So it's a little bit of it's a chaotic, for, you know, lack of a better word.
Oh, yeah. And our colleagues over at the Sun-Times also talked with the woman who was hit by the car, right, Mitch?
Yeah, yeah. Our colleagues, Tom Shuba and Mohammed Samra, managed to get in contact with Heather Blair, a 66-year-old retired federal worker, who suffered a broken arm in this. I mean, it's looking back, it's miraculous that more people weren't injured, right, as crowded as that protest was. But she, you know, got away with, you know, a broken arm, which obviously is no fun. She has to get some dental work. But, mm-hmm. Yeah, she told her colleagues that the biggest thing that she's bummed about is that she can't go to the protest on Saturday. She said she had her sign made and everything. So.
Oh, my gosh. Like a true Chicagoan.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, like Laura says, tomorrow's the No Kings protest. There's a big difference kind of what's been happening all week in these unplanned protests, and makes a really interesting point that I think people probably may not know who don't do the in-depth reporting like Laura does of, like, these immigration advocates are saying, like, we didn't organize this. Protests are very organized. There are marshals. They get permits. Mm-hmm. They estimate how many people. I mean, we all know as reporters, we cover them. And when they're unplanned, that's when chaos happens.
Right.
And the other part of it that we, you know, as a sanctuary city, obviously Chicago police are not supposed to be aiding in ICE off with ICE officers unless there's a federal warrant, which, as I understand, with the people that showed up this week, there was not a federal warrant. In fact, I think it's important to note they were in the system. That's how they were able to be contacted. Correct me, Laura, if I'm wrong, but they were in the system. They are in the process of legal, trying to gain documentation.
Right. So it's good that you mentioned that because, you know, these people were following the law, right? They had been going to routine check-ins, some of them for more than 5 years, up to 10.
And you're talking check-ins at this
check-ins
Department
at
of Homeland
office.
Security yes. office in the South Loop.
Yes, yes. And they do that because that's an alternative to detention or deportation. So in the past administrations, you know, they would not be deemed as a threat or you know, they were okay. It was at the discretion of the officer that they could stay in the country. So, and, you know, now just suddenly they've decided that they no longer can stay, but they are also not given the time to go back and gather their belongings or get everything ready to leave, which is something that we are something new that we are seeing, because in the past they would show up to these check-ins and they could be given 10 days and then they'll say, okay, come back with your plane ticket and ready to go, which is the biggest difference now that they are getting arrested. Mm-hmm. Advocates believe that the reason they're getting arrested is because they want to reach that quota, right? That, that was established by DHS, which is 3,000 people a day. And so they just need to arrest them, even though they probably don't have to.
Yeah. So local leaders, they are, to your earlier point, they're bracing for more deportation raids. This is as the president is threatening to send these military troops into Democratic cities like Chicago. I want to play a little bit of what Mayor Brandon Johnson had to say. He was on this program yesterday.
If people work outside of or behave outside of the constitutional provisions that are allotted and they become aggressive, that could lead to violence. Our police department is poised and responsible to ensure that those individuals are addressed.
And so, you know, despite President Trump warning to send troops in to quell those protests we were just discussing happening tomorrow, the No Kings protests, Mayor Johnson's calling on the public to take part, and he says that he will also continue to make his voice heard.
This is not going to shift and change by one man's voice or one person's voice. It's going to take all of our collective voices together. The city of Chicago has long been known for our protests, whether it was, you know, Dr. King coming to Chicago fighting for affordable homes or public school teachers taking strikes, have led, you know, peaceful protests, and they have been effective.
So, you know, your thoughts here, the mayor's calling on residents to rise up. To me, it sounds like the community organizer side of him.
Well, you know, Chicago has always been known for its activism work. I mean, it's one of the leading cities in terms of immigrant rights. You know, I remember back in the massive march for an immigration reform when we had probably the most people marching out there. It was where the movement for the Dreamers started. It also was the first state to get licenses for undocumented people. And it's, you know, we also were the first one to have health care for undocumented elders. So it's known for it for rising up, for lack of a better word.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's really important that the mayor and the governor and other leaders make that pushback against that national narrative being pushed by maybe Trump and others that this is all pure chaos. Our police are well trained in tactics of and we have tons of organizers. what people outside of Chicago fail to understand is we have protests every day in this city. I mean, that's what this is a city. This is what, you know, this is what we do. And you can have peaceful protests. What people are really, I think, nervous about, and especially what you're seeing in LA, you know, that was the first time Trump deployed the National Guard and bypassed the governor's wishes. Mm-hmm. When that stuff like that happens, you have this conflict of how law enforcement is working. If your police don't know what ICE is doing, don't know what the National Guard is doing, that is what can create tons of confusion. So let's not just say this is protests, protesters popping off, many of whom are following protocol and have the correct, you know, permits and whatnot. So I think that is important that we do push back on that narrative.
Three Democratic governors, Mitch, this includes Illinois' J.B. Pritzker, they were in the hot seat yesterday in D.C., answering what seemed like very combative questions at times from the Republican-led House Oversight Committee. So give us some of the main takeaways for you.
The main takeaways was that, you know, there really wasn't much new ground broken during this almost 8-hour hearing. You know, Mayor Brandon Johnson kind of went through the same ordeal a few months back. And, you know, this is kind of the definition of political theater. Republican-led committee summoning Democratic governors to sort of defend policies in their states and cities that limit the cooperation that local law enforcement can have with ICE when it comes to enforcing immigration laws. And, you know, we heard from Governor Pritzker a lot that we've heard, you know, from that he's been pretty consistent on this whole way.
Pretty feisty, too.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, he pushed back a lot against Republican lawmakers who, again, the purpose of this was to sort of make Democratic areas look like crime-ridden sort of dystopias. And, you know, the counterargument from Governor Pritzker is that, you know, there's no indications that folks without legal status are any more prone to commit crimes than the average citizen.
Yeah.
And that, you know, there's a way to show some humanity to folks who are arriving here.
Yeah. At one point he said, Illinois follows the law, but we expect the federal government to follow the law as well.
Right, right. And, you know, we saw a lot of pushback on both sides, you know, shouting matches. And frankly, it kind of devolved into other conversations about hot point political sort of issues.
Transgender rights and
bathrooms. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it went off the rails more than a few times.
Yeah. Let's hear from Pritzker. When asked if he was worried the country's border czar might have him arrested over Illinois' sanctuary policies, this is what he said.
If Tom Homan were to come to try to arrest us, I can say, first of all, that he can try. I can also tell you that I will stand in the way of Tom Homan going after people who don't deserve to be frightened in their communities, who don't deserve to be threatened, terrorized. I would rather that he came and arrested me than do that to the people of my state.
You agree, Laura, that what Mitch said there, was this a lot of political theater?
Yes, because they are terrorizing the community. They are getting these people, and I don't think anyone is standing on the way of that, right? So I think that it's part of the political scene, right, to say these things from both Democrats and Republicans. I mean, targeting sanctuary laws has been part of the Trump agenda for a very long time, and it's just adding fuel to the fire that we're experiencing right now in different Democratic cities with ICE raids and whatnot. One thing that I thought was interesting, too, is that Pritzker did mention that the reason why this is happening is because it's Democrats and Republicans that are at fault for not having a immigration reform, right? And I think that an immigration reform or that conversation is so far off the spectrum right now. Mm-hmm. That is not even, I think, a possibility at this point. So it's almost like a blank statement and as a way to say, I mean, you know, both almost like take the blame off from both, both parties.
Yeah. What are you thinking, Carrie? Because you're nodding.
Well, yeah. I mean, he made Pritzker and other, you know, made the point of like, let's remember, this is your job in Congress to do this. This is the ball is in your court. And per the political circus, I mean, you had people, members of Congress that are not even on that committee appear, like, you know, Mary Miller from downstate Illinois used it as an opportunity to come after Pritzker and say he's ruining the state. Let's also, I mean, note, these are three powerful Democrats, mm-hmm. all of whom have been talked about in making further runs for president. So when, as Mitch says, you're talking about transgender issues, you're not talking about sanctuary policies, it was pretty clear they're trying to get them on the record to say something that they will use
later
when they need to run a Republican against them.
And the drama wasn't just inside that hearing. While that was going on, you had California's senior U.S. Senator Alex Padilla being tackled and handcuffed by security. This was at a press conference held by Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem in L.A. Anybody see video of that? It went pretty viral.
Yes, yes. I think it was a shock to everyone, right? The way they tackled him when he tried to ask some questions, and the DHS said, you know, Noem said that that he did not identify himself, but in the video you can hear him saying, I'm a senator. Later on, she tweeted something about having met and agreeing to talk, but it was pretty dismissive. I think that that raised alarm about if that is how a senator is treated, what can be expected to,
And this happened during the committee hearing that Governor Pritzker was at, and, you know, pretty quickly became a topic of conversation there. And, you know, I think also pretty predictably, we kind of saw the arguments fall along partisan lines. Obviously disturbing images to see a U.S. senator tackled to the ground. Just kind of fascinating. But, you know, we pretty swiftly saw Republicans accuse the senator of, just kind of unbecoming sort of conduct, where you have Democrats saying that, you know, this is basically the first step towards an authoritarian regime, or, you know, the latest step, I guess, in their view.
And why don't you know who the senior senator is in California in the state you're visiting? Like, let's do a little research before we pop into these cities and states and understand who represents those places.
I mean, it's a wild idea, Carrie. The governor also made a big point of his own immigrant history with his Jewish great-grandfather escaping violent attacks to come here to Chicago. Do you think Pritzker saw this as an opportunity to just introduce himself to that wider national audience, sort of as we've been alluding to?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, as much as this hearing was about, you know, sort of getting these viral social media gotcha moments for Republicans, just as much of an opportunity for J.B. Pritzker to, you know, sort of have this very big stage to, you know, basically challenge Tom Homan to come and arrest him. And talk about his background, his grandfather immigrating here to, or a refugee, from Ukraine. We all know that Governor Pritzker is, he hasn't been shy about his political aspirations. He's still considering whether he's going to run for a third term for governor, but we all know he's widely considered a 2028 presidential candidate. So we saw plenty of nice little clips for his campaign social media channels emerge yesterday, too.
In other local political news, Chicago aldermen, they could soon have a larger impact on whether Airbnbs are allowed in wards. Carrie, what's going on?
Yeah, Alderman Napolitano on the northwest side has been complaining because he says that he was telling his fellow alders that people are coming into O'Hare, flying in, having parties at Airbnbs near the airport. Apparently, this is also happening near Midway on the southeast side, Southwest side. I'm sorry. Yeah. According to the alder there. So, you know, Airbnb has a no party policy. Wink, wink. You know, I mean, you're not really. So, you know, they're technically not supposed to be having parties there. And alders already have, they actually already have jurisdiction over if they're, you know, people in their wards can have Airbnbs in these short-term rentals.
Yeah.
What would happen with this new ordinance is that the alder could ban them in certain precincts of the ward, but you'd have to get, 10% or something of, residents to sign on to that. I think the point he is making is that it feels a bit lawless in the sense that you call 911, you call the police, but then everybody's already gone because it's a short-term rental. So to whom does the fault fall, right? And so, apparently saying people are complaining, there's violence happening, which, is going to be a complaint if people are coming and leaving and not invested there. So that's
interesting.
The issue, the pushback being, of course, from Airbnb, that's overregulation. And then also they say that would take away from some of the taxes earned on Airbnb rentals that go toward domestic violence and unhoused people.
But a city council committee did advance the measure, it sounds like.
Yeah, but it doesn't. It seems like some of the people with whom you'd usually see aligned with Napolitano and some of a similar politics are not totally on board. Mm. So we'll see where that goes.
Mitch, Chicago's casino, it's settled an affirmative action suit. So get us caught up on that.
So when Bally's got the essentially got the license to open this casino in Chicago under former Mayor Lori Lightfoot, they were contractually required to make sure that one quarter of the casino is owned by folks from minority backgrounds, women, people of color, other socially disadvantaged groups defined by the city. This was not a terribly controversial issue until last fall, when Bally's basically opened this investment opportunity up to the public, was swiftly sued by a pair of white men from Texas who claimed that they were being discriminated against. And this is a legal argument that obviously is gained some traction under the Donald Trump's administration, mm-hmm. As he targets sort of DEI efforts. And, you know, Bally's went back to the drawing board a few months ago, actually, to rework this investment offering to basically they said they would prefer Chicago investors without specifically defining folks, as, you know, investors having to be women or people of color.
Yeah.
But this lawsuit was essentially settled last week for an undisclosed amount. And, you know, Bally's is still trying to get federal approval for this, which is, you know, they're trying to raise $250 million towards this mm-hmm. billion-dollar plus casino investment. We've talked a lot about sort of the various obstacles they've had to towards building this thing and whether or not it'll actually open by next fall. We'll see.
The men who sued were part of the American, they teamed up with the American Alliance for Equal Rights. This is an affirmative action group. And honestly, you know, reporting on this, like those, they litigate a lot, obviously, and they're actually usually pretty successful. So the writing was a little bit on the wall when Bally's announced that. And like you said, the SEC hasn't approved the IPO yet anyway.
Mm-hmm.
But they did retract that in April. That was no longer had to be, you know, the requirement in order to invest.
Let's run through a couple of quick staff changes in city government, Carrie. Chicago's chief operating officer, John Roberson, is leaving his position. He's moving to the Obama Foundation. Also, the Chicago Film Office has a new leader. Just tell us about her.
Natasha Ogeen is her name,
okay.
And she is a Chicagoan from North Lawndale, has been worked in the industry sort of as a location scout, producer, et cetera. That position has not been filled for like half a year. Her predecessor was reportedly removed by the current commissioner, and so which is part of a series of departures at DCACE, Department of Cultural Affairs, and special
right.
events. And you know, there's been a lot of tumult there, and there was a letter that went around that was signed by dozens and dozens and dozens of arts organizations who said they are worried about leadership at DCACE, and most notably because they feel like they're not getting their grants in a timely way. Some of the grants that they had, you know, previously relied on are no longer available. So, Natasha Ogeen, Chicago, I don't know if you guys have been reading about this, that, you know, fewer and fewer productions are going to LA. And so Chicago has seen a boon in recent years, and not just in recent years, but, you know, we have a pretty good tax break here in Illinois for
True.
Productions for film and TV. So more people are flocking to Chicago and Atlanta. And so that's our job, is to be an advocate and to say, this is why you should film in Chicago. Look how beautiful it is. And
yeah.
Jeremy Allen White's always here, so you should come too.
And the Chicago Board of Ed picked someone to serve as interim board president. So Macklin King.
Yes, I think a principal. I didn't cover her.
Long time CPS principal,
but an interim, we should note, and sort of ends this this period with Pedro Martinez, which has been nothing but butting heads
yeah.
with the current mayor's office. So maybe
sure.
this is a fresh start.
Mm-hmm. Let's turn to something different, Mitch. June 24th is going to mark the anniversary of the Supreme Court's decision to overturn Roe v. Wade. And Planned Parenthood of Illinois says it's treating a record number of patients right now, a quarter coming from out of state. So I know that you recently reported about this suburban police department that's illegally sharing information with a Texas sheriff searching for a woman who got an abortion. What?
So there's this huge network of license plate readers on highways, on police cruisers, across the nation, essentially. And Illinois passed a law a couple years ago saying that basically that data can't be used to aid out-of-state agencies who are potentially tracking down women who are seeking abortions in other states because it's illegal in their own state. They can't use that information to track down people who are undocumented. You know, essentially can't be used in any immigration-related cases. And Illinois Secretary of State Alexis Janulis' office basically found out recently that Mount Prospect Police had potentially inadvertently shared some of this license plate data with a Texas sheriff's office that was searching for a woman who had gotten an abortion recently.
Really?
The case gets a little bit convoluted.
And some immigration-related matters too, right?
Hundreds of cases, apparently, too. Immigration-related cases, that is.
Wow.
That Mount Prospect Police, you know, they say that this was not something that they intentionally did, that basically, you know, this national network of cameras, other departments can search 83,000 of these cameras nationwide, kind of in one, with like a click of the button in this network, which is kind of wild to think about from a lot of different perspectives.
Well, so was it a data breach or did they give them the keys is where I'm sort of confused.
That's, yeah, everyone's a little bit confused on that.
Okay.
And Alexis Janulis, that's why the state essentially...
He thinks other Illinois police departments are doing this.
It seems very likely that a lot of departments have inadvertently been sharing data in these investigations. So the Secretary of State's office is basically conducting an audit of all these to... you know, essentially make sure that this law that was passed 2 years ago is being enforced.
Right. I think we were the first state to pass that law, Illinois was, right?
It's still the only one that has legislation like this.
Wow, wow.
Our hearts do go out to the family and friends of fallen Chicago police officer Crystal Rivera, shot by a fellow police officer during a chase on the South Side. The law enforcement community came out to honor her at a prayer vigil on Wednesday, and an investigation into her death is ongoing. We're going to take a look at what's been happening in the world of sports. So we covered this news last week, Mitch, but since you now cover the White Sox, I'd be remiss if I
now and then,
let
yeah.
this week go by without adding this to your plate here. I wanted you to tell us a little bit about Justin Ishbia and the team's potential ownership changes.
Right. So we found out last week that Justin Ishbia has the option to buy a controlling interest in the Chicago White Sox from Jerry Reinsdorf. This probably wouldn't go through until at least 2029 is the only catch on this deal. Might not happen for almost a decade until 2034, depending on how things shake out.
So there's no guarantee that we'll actually see ownership change?
No, the White Sox very characteristically a little, you know, it's a kind of a convoluted deal.
okay.
As White Sox fans can certainly empathize with. But basically, Justin Ishbia, you know, he's been floated as a potential future majority owner for a while. He's had a minority stake for some time. And, you know, him and his brother, billionaires, they're the son of another billionaire who founded America's biggest mortgage lending company. Justin and his brother already own the Phoenix Suns and the Phoenix Mercury. They also Justin himself also owns a part of a soccer team in Nashville.
Oh, wow.
But, you know, this is a guy who's almost twice his net worth is almost twice as much as Jerry Reinsdorf. And the White Sox have been very publicly campaigning for a new stadium. And as Jerry Reinsdorf has found out, it would help a lot more to have some more cash in the game.
Yes.
To get some support from state lawmakers who so far have shown zero willingness to help them finance a public, you know, a new stadium.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's sort of the first thing that comes to mind with this you know, potential future owner. But
how are fans reacting?
Fans, I think...
are they eager to see... changes to Sox leadership?
Yes, I think that's very safe to say. I think we can. That's not
is that
getting,
what they're saying is the reason for all these losses.
You know, Jerry Reinsdorf, obviously, you know, he's responsible for this White Sox only World Series in the last century, but I think he's also has a reputation, for, whether it's fair or not, for maybe not putting as much of his own money into the team as a lot of fans would like to see in terms of signing free agents. So I think the general consensus is fans would like to see this ownership change go through sooner than later.
Yes.
But we'll see how that shakes out.
Lara, you recently went to a game that was a special game that was sold out.
Yeah, it was their Mexican Heritage Night. It's their this year was their second one. Last year was their very first one.
Okay. How'd it go?
Well, it was sold out again. Definitely a little bit different than last year, I think. Last year being the very first one, it really was just an atmosphere of joy, love, you know, community. I think people were excited to be in community celebrating the Mexican culture.
Mm-hmm.
I think this year you could sense a little bit of that fear of that. Mm. You know, it was a little bit more. People. The Mexican community is a lot of mixed families, so mixed status mm-hmm. families. So a lot of people.
So you're addressing the immigration crackdown that's been happening.
Right. So a lot of people have undocumented family members, and I think that for a lot of people, it almost felt like, you know, they felt guilty for celebrating mm-hmm. or for being in a space where, you know, you're uplifting this flag or you're uplifting this community that at the same time is being targeted, right? And so, I decided to write this column because for a lot of them, it's like, well, you know, that is a different way of protesting or a different way of resisting. You know, it's a showing that resilience that lies with them of like, we are still here, mm-hmm. right? And those moments of joy are probably some of their biggest weapon to fight, you know, this moment of uncertainty.
Yeah, so you're seeing fans essentially express worry that there could be more ICE raids and they could be swept up as part of that.
Yeah, or maybe, you know, for a lot of Sox fans, a lot of them are, it's like a generational thing, right? Mm-hmm. And it's not different. It's not any different for Mexicans. My grandfather is a Sox fan, and the reason why I'm a Sox fan is because of my grandfather. I have nothing to do. I know nothing about baseball.
The reason why you gave me a side eye when I talked about the losses. Yeah. Now I know you're a Sox fan. Okay, I get it.
But actually, you know, they won that night. And that was nice. I remember last year they actually lost on their Mexican Heritage Night, but no one cared. They were just there because they were there to support, you know, the team regardless. So it was a very special night for people, definitely a little bit different than last year. But, you know, I'm glad they had it. I called them and I was like, are you guys worried that this year is going to be different than last year? Because, you know, we've seen a lot of cancellations of different events
mm-hmm.
Catering to the Latino community. And so I was, you know, I wondered if their sales were going to be affected. I think they were not. It was another sold-out game.
Well, that's good. And there's going to be another unique event at the Sox Stadium tomorrow. What's happening, Mitch?
I believe the White Sox are going to be having, or I shouldn't say the White Sox, but there's going to be a big mass celebrating. They're going to beam in the Pope.
They are the official sponsor.
Yeah.
Okay. The Pope brought to you by the White Sox.
Yes, a massive mass?
massive mass and citywide celebration. I'm sorry, Mitch, I didn't mean to jump in.
No. Pope Leo XIV, the world's most famous White Sox fan, they're going to beam him in. And I believe that event sold out like immediately. So we're going to have 40,000 or so Catholics.
Yeah, like $5 tickets. And like, I think yesterday I checked on Ticketmaster, they still have a few hundred. But he's doing this official video from the Vatican, as Mitch said, beamed in with a special message to the youth.
He was wearing a White Sox cap, right, when he greeted the public in the Vatican on Wednesday. So given the losses, the record losses carry that the teams, do you think that fans are hoping that like prayers from the Pope could get them to the playoffs?
Yeah, maybe.
Or is it more than prayers?
Is that too much?
I was going to go serious of like, listen to his message because he's been big on migration and like migrants. But in terms of the team, probably. Like Mitch said, new ownership. Fans want a winning team, you know, like they're not so much whose name it is. They want someone who's going to spend money on good players, right? So that's going to be a big event. Chicago's going to be very busy tomorrow. There's, you know, thousands and thousands expected for these No Kings protests, and then people will be heading to 35th for this mass and celebration, which is also, we should say, there's some nice Leo Catholic School in Auburn Gresham. The boys choir, they just like placed on America's Got Talent. They advanced,
really?
And they're going to perform. And then another Catholic school that did a fake conclave, they're going to perform. So it'll be quite sweet and nice, I think.
That is pretty awesome.
It's going to be pretty interesting and ironic because we're going to be, the mass is going to be happening, place of prayer for you know, Catholics. But then we're having also that protest at the same time, and we're expecting the tactical units to arrive to carry out the militarized deportation. So
two very different scenes.
Right.
Right?
Busy day in Chicago,
Yeah, and the Pope has been, I mean, he's a dual citizen in Peru, he's Peruvian mm-hmm. and American, and he has made this, you know, he has made comments about against nationalism, and he has made comments about welcoming and, mm-hmm. you know, that aren't actually that veiled. So to Laura's point, you know, there's going to be this protest against these crackdowns on immigration, and then he's going to be over here. So it'll be interesting to hear what his message is.
Right. Yeah, I'm interested to know if he will mention any of that that's happening.
Well, in other news, some of us might remember the iconic Signature Room restaurant on the 95th floor of the Hancock when it closed back in 2023. We just learned what the new space will look like.
We did.
What do you know, Carrie?
I was there. It will be a multi-deck, multi-floor. So it'll be 94, which is the current 360 Chicago, where you can go see and you can do that tilt thing.
Which I still haven't done.
And I'm not going to do
it. I don't know if I'm ever going to do the tilt, though. Yeah, that's a lot.
That's scary. And then 95th floor will also be an observation deck. And then the 96th floor will be for private event space. So it'll be the cities and maybe, and they said one of the only few in the world, multi-deck observation, multi-floor
observation deck.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah, so... You know, I mean, like you said, Signature Room is iconic, so people have been very eager to find out.
To go back
going
up there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Chicago also unveiled a new tourism campaign. What's the new slogan?
Not done, never out. Not done. Oh, gosh, I'm sorry. Not done. I was there when the unveiling. Not done, not outdone.
Okay.
And so the new tourism CEO, Kristen Reynolds, she's been in the position about a month. She came from Long Island. She said, you know, you can read it a lot of ways. Like, we're not done. We always are perfecting. Mm-hmm. And we're not outdone. And, you know, it's quite lovely. And they're it's going to be in Spanish, obviously, as well. So the campaign is everywhere.
It'll take some getting used to. I'll have to try to get that to roll off my tongue in some way. All right. Most weeks, we like to end the recap on happy news. But yesterday, unfortunately, delivered more tough news for our industry. The U.S. House narrowly approved President Trump's request to cut public media funding. That federal funding makes up about 6% of Chicago Public Media's budget, but at rural radio stations like WILL in central Illinois, it is 20%. Mm-hmm. We also heard news that the Chicago Tribune will be offering buyouts to its journalists. And so, you know, we're going to keep up the good fight on our end as long as
Absolutely.
We can.
As long as we can.
As long as we can. We'll leave it there. That's it for the weekly news recap. My thanks to Carrie Shepherd from Axios, Laura Rodriguez-Presa from the Chicago Tribune, and Mitch Armantrout of the Sun-Times. Thank you all.
Thank
Just
you.
A quick correction. It's never done, never outdone. Not
See,
not.
I,
never
again,
done, never outdone.
Again, we got to get used to this new slogan.
Thanks, Sasha.
That's it for Reset. This episode of the Reset Podcast was produced by Andrea Guffman. It was edited by Meha Ahmed and mixed by Micah Yasin. Every Friday, Reset brings you the news you need to know in under an hour. But if you want a few updates throughout the week, sign up for our newsletter. It comes out on Mondays and Fridays, and you can subscribe at wbez.org/reset. I'm Sasha Ann Simons. Thanks for listening. We'll meet again tomorrow.
I love how WBEZ shows different sides of the story. I never feel like it's too polarized, and I think the reporters do an excellent job of trying to get the full story, trying to show different other sides. I'm often, when I'm listening to public radio, think in my mind, well, what about X? Or like, I have another question. Or like, have they thought about X? And most of the time, WBEZ thinks about all of it, which I really appreciate.